Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. Today we've got a guest who has traveled a unique journey in life. She has put her story into a book, Suitcase Filled with Nails, Lessons Learned from Teaching Art in Kuwait. Yvonne Wakefield is my guest, and I think you're going to find her story a fascinating one. We're going to be talking about the real life in the real world of the Middle East. Yvonne Wakefield, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you and good morning.
There is a lot of information in your book, but I want to go first to the introduction because you have in the very first paragraph a statement about how on the cover of Time magazine, and this was August the 8th, of 2010. There's a photographic portrait of an Afghani woman. She was 18 years of age, whose nose and ears had been cut off on the orders of the Taliban because she had run away from abusive in-laws, and she was left for dead. That was such a powerful, powerful paragraph. When I read it, I wrote in the side border, hideous. And you go in there, you know, there's detail that you go into there, but your story is about when you taught in Kuwait for 5 years. And what was poignant to me, Yvonne, is that you said, I did not go to Kuwait with an agenda or with a mission or to enforce ideas. You went to do what you were hired to do. You went there to teach art. How did this come about? Why had you tried to find a job teaching overseas? Why did you want to go overseas? And how was it that the Middle East was introduced to you? Why did you choose that?
Well, first of all, I taught there for 6 years. And before I applied for that position, which I found advertised in one of my scholarly academic journals, I was happily ensconced as an art specialist in the local school district. But having a PhD wasn't going to actualize in that capacity. So I've been looking around for university positions and saw that advertisement, applied for it, pretty much on a fluke. It was offered to me the day that I had to renegotiate my contract in the school district. So I had about a day to think it over, and I applied for it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was accepted. I applied for the acceptance.
Now, were there any particular protocols when they asked you to come over? You'd call Kuwait a diamond in the middle of the Middle East. Why?
A diamond in the rough. Because in my travels in the Middle East, Kuwait was really unique in that it retained a lot of its cultural heritage and its Kuwaiti way, in contrast to the progressiveness and the development of the city. For instance, if you went to Dubai or Abu Dhabi, I never got the sense of the culture that I did in Kuwait.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that there's many things that go on in the areas, depending on where you are in the Middle East, and I know that there has been phenomenal cultural shifts because of the various political anglings that have evolved in tribal disputes and other things. You made a statement right in the beginning of your book that if you looked back on what you were leaving behind, you would never have left for Kuwait. Now, of course, that's always hindsight. But you were embarking on a real adventure, Now, you were married. How did your husband feel about you going overseas to this environment that was totally foreign to you?
Well, the idea was really foreign to both of us because prior to that, I think we'd spend maybe in our 20 years of marriage, or then it was 15, probably only a night or two apart. But he's always been incredibly supportive in my professional development, and this was one aspect, and he said, it's your decision. It was one of the harder decisions I ever made, including leaving my little dog behind. That was hard.
Now, when you entered into the Middle Eastern environment, when you first got there, what was your very first impression? What was it that really got your attention immediately?
Well, immediately, and this is one thing that readers have to understand, is this was 2004, and it was right after the Iraqi Freedom War. So a lot of the expatriate force had left the country. And when I arrived at the Kuwait airport, which is a totally transformed airport now, there were few of any English signs, and I didn't read Arabic. I didn't at that point see any Westerners, and I was immediately taken by the Kuwaiti traditional garb, which is the abaya and the hijab for women and the dastasha for men. And then the second thing was just trying to negotiate the entry process without knowing the language or being able to read the signs.
Mm-hmm. Now, that was interesting to me because I would have expected that there should be some kind of an understanding of the language before you'd be hired to take on a job in another country.
Well, in this particular position, English was the language of instruction. So I was not required to speak Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been helpful to, negotiate better. But after a year or so, I learned enough Arabic to get around.
You say, Eskimos have 12 words for snow. Kuwaitis must have as many for different types of dust. Powdery, gritty dust, greasy, sneezy, wheezy, stingy, teary, choking dust, yellow, okra, orange, and gray dust. Dust you can smell but cannot see. Blinding dust with an aftertaste. My goodness, what a visual that is. It makes you feel like you've got to have a dustbuster with you every step of the way. How was the climate and the actual country environment that you were in like? That description gives us a visual. We think it's a constant dust storm. Were you in desert? I mean, that is what I'm assuming that this would portray.
Well, yes, Kuwait is, I think, the only country in the world that doesn't have any topical water, any lakes or anything like that. And it is a desert that meets the Persian Gulf. But there are dust seasons, and there are just dust in the air, but there are some incredible, beautiful, clear days in Kuwait. And I actually learned to like the climate a lot. There wasn't a lot of opportunity to get out and climb mountains or hike or anything, but I found ways to exercise outside. There were instances where they had the shamal winds, which are the dust storms, and I had lived in Minnesota for some time and remember walking out to my car and you can see the footprints in the snow. Well, it was the same in during the dust storm. You could see your footprints in the dust. And mm-hmm. You had to take newspapers to wipe the dust off your windshields.
Now, you end up going to the college and you learn a term very quickly, inshallah, which is said almost at the end of just about every conversation. But when you were at the college, you learned that there was a distinction between the female professors and the male professors. What was that? Why didn't you get what's considered perks?
Oh, it was because I was a woman. In the contract, it said my spouse, and if I had children, they would be flown over and provided for in Kuwait and given an allowance. Well, that opportunity only applied to male professors.
Mm-hmm. Are you still with me?
Yes, yes.
Oh, I just heard a click, and I thought, uh-oh, something happened to the phone line. All right. Well, that is something that you found out about right away. You were told by a Dr. Bedar, and I may not be pronouncing his name correctly, so don't hesitate to correct me if you need to. The one thing that he said to you in the beginning when you first arrived there is that the government had always provided for the people of Kuwait, and that according to him, they don't want anything, even though you found the living accommodations that you had left a lot to be desired. But he said education, his statement to you is that we must teach students to think for themselves. Kuwaitis do not know art, do not know how to appreciate art. And I really found that quite fascinating, especially with all the limitations that they put on you. Talk about your class, the very first class that you had, and what you had to discover.
Well, what I discovered first is that I pronounce it Dr. Bedar, and in fact, in the book, everybody's name is changed because these are real people I'm talking about. What I discovered in my first class, visually first startled me because about 99% of my students wore the hijab, the dark covering.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them wore the full face niqab. So number one, I was new at teaching this college position. Number two, I was looking out at a visual that I had known as a Catholic school student. Okay, now all of a sudden, I was looking at the nuns, and the nuns weren't looking at me.
Mm-hmm.
But what I also discovered is after I broke the ice with these students, they were really willing to engage with me, really open to learning, but they needed me to give them permission to think freely and creatively. For instance, if I gave a drawing assignment, they'd come back and they'd say, well, can I do this? Can I do this? Should I do it this way? Is it this way? I say, do it your way. And I think it was that type of freedom that they hadn't experienced either inside a classroom or perhaps in their own creative evolvement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think to allow creativity, even in the Chinese culture, and I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the Chinese culture is just absolutely awesome with some of the beauty that they've created. But there often has been, in the past few generations, a suppression of the creativity in some respects, and then also in the Japanese culture. So when you were talking about this in the Middle Eastern culture, I thought how amazing it was, because even in early American culture, that often was the case with women, dependent on what your background was. This was not something you were allowed to do. You had to follow certain protocols. This was maybe all right for men to do, but not for women to do. And I imagine that flashback to the Catholic background and looking at the nuns and this type of thing, the associations were probably extremely interesting. Now, you bring out in your book a word, wasta. And this was a very important word because it meant wasta gave you the power to accomplish some of the things that you needed to accomplish, and it depended on your nationality, the organization you worked for, and who works with and against you. This is quite a complex situation. And how did you find yourself dealing with this?
Well, first of all, as an American, I didn't have wasta. It's a Kuwaiti connection. But I did have some friends who offered me wasta, which meant they offered me help in negotiating paperwork and other situations like that. I also found it was a really powerful undermining tool. I mentioned in there a term called kiss and kill.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have somebody shake your hand, wouldn't be a man, or smile at you and greet you, and then turn around and undermine you really profoundly in some way. And as an American, I had no retribution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you had an association with a Dr. Haifa. Now, this is a woman that is very, very well educated, and she teaches you so much. She teaches you so much, and you express in the book that she said that there was a time when they didn't have choices. There weren't any choices for women. And she said, look at the women today. They have opportunities. They have so much more. And what do? They hide behind the veil inside and outside of themselves. It is worse today than 20 years ago. Bin Laden had scared everyone into hiding, and the men are no different. That must have been a very powerful moment for you to sit in the presence of this woman who lives in this world. How did you feel about that conversation with her?
Well, it happened when I originally met her, and over the course of the 6 years I was in Kuwait, I'd understand the evolution. And one of the things I learned is during the Iraqi invasion in 1991, a lot of the Kuwaitis went to Saudi Arabia in the protection of Saudi Arabia and created alliances with that country, which is ultra-conservative. So they came back more conservative than when they had left. And the other part about hiding behind the veil, and I have nothing against the veil at all, is that some people would use it to project a privilege that nobody else could have, because it would state that they'd come from perhaps a very wealthy, powerful, conservative, influential Kuwaiti family. And you didn't want to mess with it. For instance, I had oftentimes had my car blocked in by another car who, instead of using a parking space or finding a parking space elsewhere, they would just park behind my car because it was close. And I couldn't get out, so I'd wait, and a woman totally covered in niqab would then get in the car and drive away, no excuse. Well, she had that right, she had that privilege, so she thought, because she was wearing the veil. And I'd had other people like that cut right in front of me in lines, and that's, they used the power of the veil that way.
Your students were a fascinating group of young women. Most of them came from fairly affluent families, didn't they?
In the beginning, yes. And towards the end of my teaching, we were getting some students from north of Kuwait, from the Jawhara region, who weren't as wealthy. But these women enjoyed a privilege and entitlement that most women I know will never enjoy. For instance, they have, their tuition is paid. They actually get a stipend to go to college. Their books are either paid for or discounted. So they have no student loans to pay. And they live with their families, their parents, until they're married. So they're not paying rent, or health care is free. So they have none of the economic issues that face young women in America today, who are trying to go to school full-time.
Mm-hmm. One of the components that I know is very frustrating to you as a teacher is that the students often cheated, that they wouldn't always do the work that was assigned, and that if you didn't give them a good grade, if they went home and said, well, this is what they deserved, they would pout. I mean, it was really something. You were supposed to give them a passing grade whether they earned it or not. That had to have been very frustrating to you.
I was actually literally shocked the first time that I had to confront that situation. I'd had Kuwaiti colleagues tell me that students would come and bargain for grades, that they would even bring their families into my office, and I would get phone calls also from influential members of the family. Until that situation happened to me, I thought it was still myth. But for instance, the first semester, I gave a student an A-, and I graded according to my book. If the numbers added up, that's what they added up to. I didn't go one way or the other. And she had her full niqab on, and she demanded an A. And I said, why? And she said, because I want an A. I said, well, it doesn't add up to an A. It adds up to an A minus. And she was crying, and her niqab was going in and out and in and out, and her glasses were fogging up. So then she goes, and then I go out to my office, and I come back, and she's sitting in outside my office with a mother and an aunt who then try to persuade me to give her an A. Also, if the student did not like the grade that I gave them, they could call a council with the deans and other administrators to argue why they should have a better grade. And I had to go before several of those councils. Even if the student had, it was proven that the student had plagiarized a paper, mm-hmm. that student would still file a complaint against me. And this could be very dangerous, because in the time I was there, I had three colleagues from different schools who had not met the expectations of a student. And when they went to go home for the summer or travel, they found they couldn't leave Kuwait because a travel ban had been put on them by some family member who was not happy with the grade that they gave their student.
That's scary.
That one always made my throat parch and my knuckles grow white every time I had to go to the, every time I would leave Kuwait to the airport, because you never knew if you had a travel ban on you until you got to the airport.
Mm-hmm. And also, the faculty was told that a student's lack of attendance cannot be counted against her grade. There's so many fascinating parts to your book, A Suitcase Filled with Nails, because you really liked your students. There was a lot of this stuff that went on during the years that you were going there, but really, you got to know these young women, and some of them were just wonderfully talented. Others were mediocre, yet I like to think that because of your involvement there, that there was an understanding, there was an acceptance, a transferring of an awareness of a different level of thinking, a different type of thinking. And maybe it took with a few, not all of them, but with a few, and they just absolutely were so fond of you. But these, most of them were, you know, young women that had been raised by servants. They never had been expected to do anything because everything was done for them. I have to chuckle because I was reviewing something about a woman's experience with billionaires, and they had everything they wanted. They didn't have to worry about anything. And I thought, my goodness, that's existed in just about every culture. And those people, when they've never had to work for anything or do anything, then they would have their servants do the work that needed to be done for the class or what have you. It's really interesting. You bring something out, too. You said that you couldn't use oil paints in your class because the classroom you had did not have any disposal process for chemical waste and no ventilation. And, of course, that's pretty toxic. And this is something that you ended up shifting over to acrylics. And what was the most wonderful thing about your students that when you were there just literally nourished you as a teacher, that you really felt what you were doing with art was touching something in them?
It started gradually, and it was by giving them permission to create what they wanted to create from within themselves. And there was this project I always had a drawing or painting class do called the narrative drawing or painting. And it had to tell a story, and the title had to reflect the content of the painting, and they had to use overlapping objects and one reference material. Well, throughout the course, that was usually the last assignment, throughout the course I could see them grow less hesitant about the use of the media, grow more expressive. They would start to take off their abayas. They would come early to class. They would stay late to class. And the resulting imagery just always amazed me, because you have to think, if these students had had any art before, it was usually high school drawing, and it meant you copied something. You copied it exactly the way it was. There was no room to twist your imagination, no real room for expressing yourself differently in the media. And eventually, we got a coffee pot in there, and people would bring snacks, and I'd bring library books, and it just became like an open studio. And I'd find students in there even when classes weren't held, and they'd be working, or maybe they'd just be reading a book. Maybe they'd be taking a lunch break where they didn't have to wear their abaya or niqab. And it just became this really alive artwork. I mean, the studio and the climate in there was a piece of art.
Mm-hmm. When you were working with your students, you have a very poignant story about eggs. And there was a bag of sooty eggs. I'll just say this, and I'll let you tell the story about how these sooty eggs ended up being eaten by someone, a very, very poor woman that worked at the college, and what the students told you, why she was getting the eggs. Tell us that story.
Well, first of all, the woman was one of the third country nationals, and these are the people that come in and do the grunt work. They clean, they sweep the streets. They're paid probably paid less than $100 a month, but from wherever they came from, that's more than they could make in the country. So there are always a lot of these little women in cotton uniforms picking up and cleaning and sweeping around the college. And after one drawing assignment, I had the students bring in an egg, a hard-boiled egg, because we were doing chiaroscuro drawings, black and white vine charcoal drawings of these eggs. And it was, I think, the end, right before the weekend, so I said, take your eggs, don't put them in the garbage can, because I don't know when the garbage will be taken out. And so we all walked down, 22 students and me, and at the end of the stairs was one of these little women in the cotton uniforms with the broom, and the girls started to hand her the eggs. And I stopped them, and I said, look, the garbage can's right over there. Don't have her throw your garbage away, because they were used to having other people pick up their trash.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the students said, we're giving her the eggs to eat because they don't get enough to eat. They're not like the maids in our house that eat the same food as we do. These women and their men, many men too, millions of them, live in camps and eat institutionalized food that none of us would probably ever want to teach. So, and many of them didn't even have any clothes except their uniforms. And that's the lesson I learned then. And one time, I also mentioned in the book, we had a picnic out on the grass. And one of the reasons I also wanted to do that, besides just connecting with the students, is because I knew there'd be a lot of food left over.
Mm-hmm.
And the third country national women would get to eat it. So when we were all done, the leftover food was boxed up and given to them.
Mm-hmm. Very poignant story. You bring out many different cultural aspects. One of them is that there was a person, I believe her name is Haifa. She said to you, this is Kuwait. We grow up learning to verbally abuse each other beginning in childhood. Now, when that happened, you submitted a letter of resignation shortly after that. There were a lot of things that went on, and you actually had a woman by the name of Belinda who was just hideous. She was absolutely virulent in everything that she did in relationship to you, and this was what Huffer was, I think, addressing. She said, this is just part of what we deal with here in this environment, in this part of the world. There, you give such a phenomenal, I almost want to say a diverse verbal picture of what goes on in another part of the world. You, as you said, you've been teaching there for 6 years. And what made you decide to stop?
I reached the threshold of being intimidated, being undermined. I had stayed on in order to get myself promoted. I had all the requirements, which threatened the male Kuwaitis because they didn't need to get promoted because they always had a job no matter what. And I think that threatened them, so they ratcheted it up. They're intimidating, tactics, and it just got to be the point where it was becoming so intimidating. I was actually frightened for my safety, not because I was living near a war zone in Iraq, but I was really afraid of the tribal connections and the way that they were continually undermining me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if I had been a Kuwaiti, I would have had some type of restitution. As an American working for the Kuwaiti government, I had nothing. I did not work in a compound like a lot of expatriates do, or work for one of the big oil companies, so you have that camaraderie. I didn't have any of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you would not trade the experience for anything, but your book, Suitcase Filled with Nails, the title is there for a reason, and within the book itself, that will be self-explanatory. But your website, that people can go to, because you are going to have an artistic exhibit in Yakima, Washington, from January the 11th to March 8th at the Larson Gallery. But people can go to your website, YvonnePepinWakefield.com, and that's Y-V-O-N-N-E, P like Paul, E-P-I-N, Wakefield.com. Yvonne, your book is really an eye-opener, and I think it gives a very compassionate, insightful, factful view of a world that, my goodness, in many ways reminds me of the days of early America relative to the attitudes towards women, but also you give an insight into the cultural perspective that you experienced in that small section of the world that you had the opportunity to be a part of for 6 years. I want to thank you for being my guest today.
Well, thank you very much, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Have a wonderful life, and I'm glad you're back in the U.S. so that you could share your story.
Well, this
is Donna Sebo. Check out the book Suitcase Filled with Nails by Yvonne Wakefield. It's an amazing read. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open, 888-627-6008. My goodness, can you believe it? We've got Christmas coming up. I swear, it just seems like we blink, and the holidays, just once they start, just Halloween comes around, and then everything else starts moving into place. Well, next week, and all of this information will be posted on BBS this weekend, we've got a wonderful, fascinating lineup of guests. We're going to be talking about a phenomenal dog whose name is Leaf. Alan Anderson is going to be my guest on Monday, And then we are going to be talking about an aspect of the Andean, the South American culture. We are going to be talking with Hillary Webb. And then a woman who, after 1,000 years, is getting recognition. She was a Renaissance woman 1,000 years ago. And wow, is she dynamic even for today's world. We're going to be talking about Hildegard of Bingen. Matthew Fox is going to be my guest. Then Niano, who is a South African artist. We were not able to reach her last month. We have rebooked her. We're going to be playing her music, hearing her story, knowing who I am. So via technology, we will be traveling to South Africa. And then I will be talking with Dr. Katie Evans about The Unfortunate Hero. We are dedicating a program to our military people and Dr. Katie's work with PTSD. So we've got a dynamic, very eclectic mix next week, and we're going to have such a phenomenal grouping of guests. If you want to find out more about it, within these next couple of days, all of this detailed information regarding each of the upcoming guests, as well as a brief write-up, will be under show information. Also, my newsletter will be coming out, and you will hear about things coming up via the newsletter. Life is so amazing. And when I think of what Yvonne has experienced in Kuwait, being in a culture, as an American woman, being well-educated, and having the opportunity to do things pretty much the way that she wants to do them here in the U.S., and then to be in a culture that doesn't have that. When you study history, you'll find that that is a recurring theme. And in today's patterning, we are discovering that there are many different parts of the world where women are beginning to find their voice. They're beginning to find it in Africa. They're beginning to find it in many ways in the Asian world. There are so many aspects that are starting to bloom. And what is the purpose behind it? We should get past of saying men are superior, women are superior, and value people as people, whether they're male or female. And when it comes to education, you all have the right to reach out for the education that you want. You have the right to make choice. But interestingly enough, people go into patterning historically over and over again. There's a side of the human personality that too frequently says, I want someone to take care of me. I feel like I should not have to think. I shouldn't have to make decisions. I don't want to do this. And I can remember even being taught this. And I'm not that old, for heaven's sakes. And by golly, it's amazing how women will perpetuate myths that go on and on and on that actually disengage them from being responsible and participatory in life, really making their world a better place. And the sad thing is, and I don't remember who said this, but women, when they are not educated and when they are put into a very negative role, it affects the men in a very, very negative way. And what happens is that the men suffer as well as the women. And it's a very difficult thing to see. To have dominion in your own space means that you must take on the responsibility of thinking for yourself, standing on your own 2 feet, being willing to be responsible for who you are, whether you're male or female. No blame game here. You pick up yourself, whatever you're going through, and you move on. You're accountable for who you are. You're responsible for who you are. Yet you make mistakes, okay, that's a given. But you move forward. And that's one of the gifts that I feel that the United States offered to people around the world, regardless of their cultural background. So don't ever forget, your mind belongs to you. Your mind is your own. What you put into your mind is also your choice. The adage, garbage in, garbage out, is very true. So remember, If you find yourself criticizing another culture, or you find yourself saying, well, they just are ignorant people, make sure that your own level of ignorance isn't standing out too much. Be willing to educate yourself. I think Yvonne learned a lot from these wonderful students that she had, good, bad, and indifferent. But what happened is she came back more aware as a person of what she really wanted her life to be in many, many ways. So her book, Suitcase Filled with Nails, is a very, very powerful one. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat at 888-627-6008. Medical science is making some fascinating strides. I don't think we're even able to keep up with half of it because we have just got so many wonderfully talented people that are saying, let's look at things differently, whether it's through homeopathic means or whether it's through energy healing or through surgery or other things. The steps that we're making and going forward remind me of Star Trek. In fact, I had to chuckle. I was listening to a commentary on a radio show when I was out and about doing some errands yesterday, and the person was saying, remember Star Trek, how they had these little doodads in their hands that they would flip open? It was like a cell phone. Now, when was Star Trek started? Was that back in the 60s? I don't remember exactly. But when Star Trek, when they had that, look at what we do today. People flip open their phones or they have smartphones. They were using little square pads when the nurses were dealing with patients on the spaceship. They had those little square pieces of stuff, and look at the technology we've got today. Evaluations made physically of a person with a little handheld item, brain damage, or gee whiz, you had this infection, or you got an alien inside of you. All of this was in Gene Roddenberry's original Star Trek. Well, a lot of people are not aware that many individuals on his writing staff and for many of the other Star Trek programs that came out, were physicists. These were people whose minds were moving so far into the future, they said, we're going to have a great time. We can make this stuff up. Well, it's a precursor to what has evolved today. Science and technology has moved forward, and it continues to move forward. So with I forget how many satellites that are up in the wild, vast spaces of space that we're able to link with, so our GPS systems work and all kinds of other things work effectively and well, we are seeing a level of sophistication that is going to change our lives dramatically. Well, one of the things that came to my attention is a problem of hearing. Now, that's getting down to some real basics in life. And I have had some very dear friends who have lost their hearing. They were professional musicians. Today's young musicians are admonished by their teachers to wear specialty hearing pieces to put in their ears so they can hear the music, but they're not going to lose their hearing. They can hear all of the fine tones, like if you're in a concert with an orchestra, but you're not going to lose your hearing like the drummers typically did or people that are around extremely loud noises. Well, if one ear is not transmitting sound at all, there is a wonderful thing that's evolving here, and I think we're going to see more and more of this occurring, where your teeth are going to restore hearing. Now, that sounds a little far-fetched, doesn't it? It sounds like something out of a sci-fi movie. Well, you know how when you eat a crispy carrot or something crunchy, you can hear it? You'll hear it in your head? Well, that's because the bones in your head transmit sound. And there is a system called sound bite that's being developed. And what it is, it's a small piece worn behind the ear that detects and wirelessly sends sounds to another device worn in the mouth. Don't ask me how they do it. I don't have a picture in front of me. They say they send the sound waves through the teeth and bones in the skull to both inner ears. Now, this technology is available. So if you know of anyone that's got a hearing problem, I strongly encourage you to help them investigate this, because it really makes a difference. And I know I'm going to pass along the information to this friend of mine who's totally lost his hearing because he was a drummer. In fact, he just retired last year because he couldn't hear anything anymore. Soundbite is the name of the technology. Apparently, there's about 50 hearing centers that are now nationwide, and they are hoping, if you know of elderly people that could use this technology, they're hoping that Medicare will be accepting it. So check out Soundbite, S-O-U-N-D-B-I-T-E. Now, the source of this, you can go to Sonitus Medical. Sonitus Medical, and they're located in San Mateo, California. You can go to their website, soundbitehearing.com. Soundbitehearing.com. Great stuff to know about. Donna Sebo here. I've got a yummy chocolate cookie recipe that I want to share with you. So have that pad of paper and pen handy. When we come back, we'll be getting a touch of that stuff that gives your taste buds a golden glow. Chocolate. We'll be back in just a minute. Don't go away.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. This cookie recipe is just absolutely marvelous. Now, it's not going to make a huge amount. This chocolate recipe, it's called a double chocolate espresso cookie. Now, if you are not a big fan of coffee, coffee and chocolate go a long way together. They just seem to blend really well. Now, this will make about 15 cookies. So this is something that is, it's got a most common ingredients in it, but I think you'll be surprised and how deliciously flavorful it is. Now, it's going to take about 45 minutes to make these, and as I said, you'll end up with about 15 cookies. So here you go. You're going to need a third of a cup of dark chocolate-covered espresso beans. Mm-hmm. A third of a cup of dark chocolate-covered espresso beans. You're going to need 1 cup of all-purpose flour, 1 cup of all-purpose flour, 2 tablespoons of unsweetened cocoa powder. Go for the best dark chocolate you can get. 2 tablespoons of that wonderful unsweetened cocoa powder, 1 teaspoon of baking powder, 1 teaspoon of baking powder, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter at room temperature, 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter at room temperature, 6 ounces of your semi-sweet chocolate, and if you want to make it easy, just use the chips. But you can take the chunks of chocolate, if you like that look or you know, texture in your cookie, you can do that too. So 6 ounces of semi-sweet chocolate, chopped or chocolate chips, 3/4 cup of sugar, 2 large eggs at room temperature, and then you need 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, and then an additional cup of semi-sweet chocolate chips or chunks. Okay, now this is what you do. You want to heat your oven up to 300 degrees. You need 2 baking sheets, and you're going to line those with parchment paper. And in a bowl, in a food processor, you want to chop your espresso beans. That's done in just a few seconds. And in a medium bowl, you want to whisk together your espresso beans, flour, cocoa powder, baking powder, and salt, your dry ingredients. Your butter and chocolate you want to microwave in just a few seconds. For about 90 seconds, you want to stir it. Heat for about another minute. Stir until the chocolate is completely melted. And then in another bowl, you want to have your sugar, eggs, 2 tablespoons of water, and your vanilla. And gradually, you want to add your dry ingredient mixture and stir it until it's thick and smooth. Then you want to fold in your melted chocolate. After that is mixed, then you want to stir in your chips. Now, you're going to need a quarter of a cup for measuring out the dough. It'll come out to 15 cookie balls. And if you want to get the dough out easily, if you have some olive oil or if you have some nonstick cooking spray, just spray the cup, and then the dough will come right out. You want to put those quarter cup balls of cookie dough onto your prepared baking sheets, putting them about 2 inches apart. You're going to bake them at 300 degrees for 18 to 22 minutes until they get slightly puffy and the top of the cookie begins to crack. Oh, the smell is heavenly. And, oh, are they going to be good with a hot cup of cocoa or just as a delightful item to serve as a special treat after maybe a holiday meal or, hey, just do it for yourself. Yum. Good stuff. So I'm going to just share that recipe with you today. Also, if you want to give me a buzz, 888-627-6008 is the telephone number to call. On May 13, 1966, a local physician, Dr. Darquia, and a friend who was a photographer, well, they celebrated Dr. Darquia's birthday. He received a very unusual gift. It was a stone, and this stone had unusual carvings on it. Now, the physician whose birthday was being celebrated lived in Ica, which is the capital town of a small Peruvian coastal province, and it's about 185 miles south of Lima. Now, he had always been interested in the ancient history of his country, and he was surprised by this gift that was given to him, because when he looked at the design on the stone, he identified a species of fish that was extinct millions of years ago. Well, he was so excited about his birthday gift, because it was obviously a very, very, very old carved stone. Well, a couple of brothers in the area happened to hear about it, and they were collectors of ancient artifacts, pre-Inca artifacts, in fact. And they said, you know, we have found stones like this. We've got them in our collection, and we can tell you where there's more like them. Well, he had a hard time believing this, but he went to this site and was able to gather up all kinds of stones. And he found a farmer who had all kinds of stones. This man ended up with thousands of stones that had been very meticulously engraved with particular scenes. And by the end of the 1970s, he had more than 11,000 of these uniquely engraved stones. And I've got a picture of one of them in front of me, and it's amazing because it has a depiction on this one stone, beautifully carved in, of humans fighting dinosaurs. Now, there's a lot of archaeologists that say, oh, these are just fakes. However, it has been determined that this is not a fake, that there were people living during the time of the dinosaurs. So when things like this are found, so often they are just dismissed because they're preconceived ideas that we only go back 9,000 years or 10,000 years. Humans have lived on this planet for millions of years. Cultures have come and gone, and because of technology today, we're finding out more and more about people's that seemingly disappeared off the face of the earth, but did they really? Did they actually perhaps merge in with another culture? Lots of questions. Maybe they'll never be answered. But wow, isn't it fascinating to explore the possibilities? This is Donna Sebo. I hope you have an absolutely magnificent weekend wherever you might be. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. No matter what culture you're born into, whether you're male or female, this life is yours to be lived with grace, with purpose, and with passion. Enjoy the journey. This is Donna. I'll be back with you on Monday. Talk with you then, right here at bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.